Thank you all for coming. I know in particular the weather outside is tempting us with all sorts of other alternatives to tort law, but I'm glad to see people have made the fundamentally sound choice of investing in tort law rather than investing in sunshine. Let me start by thanking the London law firm of Cohen Hiley LLP for its generous sponsorship of the Tort Law Research Group's public lecture series for 2011-2012. This is only the second year that the group has been running, and it's thanks to Cohen Hiley that we've been able to organize some very strong events that help us raise the profile of tort law here at Western. Today's speaker is Nick McBride, and Nick is a fellow in law at Pembroke College, Cambridge. I know Pembroke College well because it was my spouse's college when she and I were both at Cambridge. Nick is the co-author of a well-known textbook called Tort Law, the fourth edition of which will be published next month. He's also the author of the best-selling Introduction to the Study of Law, Letters to a Law Student, which, to give it some of its Canadian context, would be, it seems to me, equivalent to Stephen Wadhams's introductory book that we mandate all of our incoming students to read before arriving for first year. Now, I'm sure students in the room will be at least passingly aware of the rivalry between Cambridge and the other place. Nick was at the other place as a fellow of All Souls College, having studied law at Brasenose College. The Tort Law Research Group's executive, incidentally, is made up of two Cambridge graduates and only one graduate from the other place. So we have a majoritarian preference for Nick's current home rather than his former one. His talk today is entitled Thinking About Tort Law, Where Do We Go From Here? It's a question to which I'd really like to know the answer, and I'm sure my students would also, and so I await Nick's talk with particular interest. He's asked that questions be saved until the end of his formal presentation. Nick McBride.
Thanks so much. I'd like to begin by thanking Jason Nyers for inviting me to come over here to talk to this fantastic discussion group. It's a great honour to be here. It's especially thrilling for me to come to Ontario because I was actually born in Ontario in the town of St. Catharines, just over 100 miles from here. And it's actually the first time I've been back to Canada since my parents returned to the UK when I was about 1 year old. So I'm really, really pleased to be here. So the subject of my talk and the paper accompanying this talk is the revolution in thinking about the nature and purpose of tort law that has been going on for the past 25 years or so. And this revolution rejects the understanding of tort law as simply a system for redistributing losses that was so prevalent in the 1960s and 1970s. The revolutionaries argue that tort law is far more important than that. It defines what basic legal rights we have against each other and what remedies we're entitled to when those rights are violated. Where A will have a legal right against B, if the law imposes a duty on B to act in some way and it does so for A's benefit. And that right will be a basic right if A doesn't have to do anything special for that right to exist or for that right to arise. So seen in this way, tort law is not some subject that can be dismissed in the way Jules Coleman once did as simply concerned with cleaning up messes, like tort law is society's janitor. Tort law is a fundamentally important part of our legal system and is present wherever we are, whatever we're doing. It's present in this room right now, telling me not to hit anyone who annoys me in the discussion and not to unjustly defame anyone in my opening remarks. So this revolution in thinking about tort law has gone through four distinct phases. The first, and this is where the side of the handout with the timeline is relevant, the first early stirrings phase lasted from 1983 to 1995. In that time, Ernest Weinrib developed his argument that tort law should be seen as a system of corrective justice, requiring individuals to correct the wrongs that they had done other people. Parallel to this, Peter Burks, eventually based in my old college, All Souls in Oxford, was, in the course of writing about the law of restitution, developing the view that tort law should not be seen as centred around a particular response, compensation, but should rather be seen as centered around an event, the commission of a legal wrong to which the law responded in a variety of ways, not just through compensation, but through other remedies as well, such as gain-based damages. So that's the first stage. The second development phase built on Weinrib and Birx's work. In 1997, just as I moved from Oxford to Cambridge, I was commissioned with Roderick Bagshaw, who's in Oxford, to write a textbook on tort law. And inspired mainly by Birx's ideas, we decided to centre the textbook round the idea that a tort involved the breach of a duty owed to another. That is, a breach of a duty that's imposed for the benefit of a particular individual, not the community as a whole. And as a result, we ended up expelling from tort law any areas of law that didn't fit that idea, such as strict liability for injuries caused by dangerously defective products and the law on public nuisance. And at the same time, two American academics, John Goldberg and Ben Sapersky, were developing a theory of tort law that both built on and reacted against Weinrib's work. They argued that instead of requiring defendants to correct the wrongs that they'd committed against other people, tort law empowered claimants by giving them a peaceful means of seeking recourse against those who had seriously wronged them. Now, the work each pair of us was doing either side of the Atlantic finally came together, and we became aware of what we were each doing when I started working around 2002 on an article arguing that when the law says that A owes B a duty of care, it's actually telling A to be careful of B's interests, and not simply warning A, as was the orthodoxy at the time, that if he carelessly harms B, he'll be held liable to pay B compensation. And in researching the article, I realised that John Benn were arguing the same thing in a 2001 article. Now, John Benn and I would have been quite happy to carry on until retirement age talking about tort law as imposing on each of us duties owed to other people, not just duties of care, but duties not to batter other people, duties not to defame other people, and so on. The fact that we tend in 2012 to talk about tort law in terms of it giving us rights against other people is due to the third phase in the revolution, which we can call the right turn phase. And this phase lasted from about 2005 to 2009. And the crucial work in the right turn phase of this revolution was a book written by a colleague of mine, friend of mine, Robert Stevens, his 2007 book, Torts and Rights. Now, this book built on the definitional legwork that had been done in writing the McBride and Bagshaw textbook. But instead of talking about, as we did, tort law as imposing duties on us that are owed to other people, Rob flipped the duty rights coin over and instead talked about tort law as endowing us with rights against other people. As Rob admits, he could have entitled his book Torts and the Duties We Owe One to Another, but that wouldn't have been as snappy. And at about the same time, a group of Canadian academics, including Peter Benson, Jason Nyers, and most importantly, Arthur Ripstein, began exploring the suggestion in Weinrib's idea of private law that Kant's doctrine of right, as set out in the first part of his Metaphysics of Morals, defined what amounted to a wrong under the law of tort. Now, under Kant's doctrine of right, we're all entitled to enjoy a maximal degree of freedom to determine for what purposes we'll employ the means at our disposal. And any interference with that freedom is wrongful, a violation of our rights. And round about 2006, Kantian tort theorists started publishing papers arguing that Weinrib was right and that in giving us the rights that it did, tort law was effectively giving effect to Kant's doctrine of right. Now, the fact that Rob's book was published at around the same time as the Kantian tort theorists were going into action and arguing very clearly and explicitly that tort law was rights-based in the sense that it gave effect to Kant's doctrine of right, has, I fear, created a great deal of confusion. So let me make it clear. You can believe that tort law gives us rights against other people without signing up to the idea that in giving us the rights that it does, tort law gives effect to Kant's doctrine of right. Someone who believes that tort law endows us with rights against other people simply believes that for every tort that exists, negligence, defamation, private nuisance, battery, false imprisonment, and so on, the law is telling people not to do whatever committing that tort involves, and it's telling people not to do this in order to protect the interests of a particular individual, not the community as a whole. Now, if you believe that, then you're one of us and you're welcome to the club. But you can become a member of our club without endorsing the Canadian view that tort law gives effect to Kant's doctrine of right and giving us the rights that it does. The Kantian tort theorists are part of the club, they are not the whole of the club. So the revolution has subsequently rolled on into its fourth establishment phase. Towards the end of 2009, Arthur Ripstein published his masterwork, Force and Freedom, Kant's Legal and Political Philosophy, which is destined to become the text for anyone wanting to interpret tort law in Kantian terms. In 2010, Goldberg and Sapersky published a canonical statement of their civil recourse theory of tort law in their Torts as Wrongs article. And the Obligations 5 conference held in Oxford the same year was devoted to the topic of rights and private law and was almost wholly given over to discussion of the current revolution in thinking about tort law. Now, it would be very easy to get carried away by all this excitement and activity into writing more and more articles and books all about how tort law is or is not rights-based in nature. But I think the wiser move at this stage would be to pause, take a breath, review what progress the revolution has made in helping us understand tort law, and think carefully about what the fifth phase of a revolution in thinking about tort law should look like, and that's the job I set myself in my paper. Taking my inspiration from David Hilbert's address to the 1900 International Congress of Mathematicians, I've structured my paper around four questions that I think we revolutionaries should be looking to answer. And yeah, you flip over the handout. The paper explains why these four questions are important, reviews the progress we've made so far towards answering them, and seeks to provide some advice and guidance to any academics who attempt to work on these questions in the future. Now, the first question has been the subject of revolution so far, the question of what tort law is, what tort law does. A represents the 1960s and 70s orthodoxy that writers such as Weinrib and Burks began to reject from the 1980s onwards. Now, I adopt the relatively thin view of tort law presented in B and C. The view is thin because it doesn't identify tort law as giving us any particular rights or identify tort law as pursuing any particular goal other than determining what basic rights we have against each other and what remedies will be available for the violation of those rights. Now, the trouble with occupying the middle ground on any issue is that you get attacked on both sides, and so it proves with my thin theory of tort law. It's attacked on one side by those who adopt an ultra-thin view of tort law, according to which tort law is simply made up of a group of causes of actions that have nothing in common other than the following two family resemblances. One, they allow claimants to sue people who are strangers to them. And two, they provide successful claimants with a range of remedies, which normally but not always include a measure of compensatory damages. On the other side, my thin view of tort law is attacked by those who adopt thicker views of tort law, under which tort law is to be identified with the pursuit or realization or instantiation of some specific goal or ideal, such as giving us rights that others not cause us loss, or that others not interfere with our independence, or that others not act in ways that seriously aggravate us. I would reject the ultra-thin view of tort law as too thin. It fails to account for a number of features of tort law. First, the way that the courts see the fact that a defendant has committed a tort as being a ground for making him liable to the claimant, rather than simply indicating that he might be sued by the claimant, with the result that pretty much the same rules apply across the board to determine what remedies will be available against someone who commits a tort. Second, the fact that we tend to shy away from saying that someone has committed a tort unless we can fairly say that they've acted unlawfully. So, for example, we tend to talk of the rule in Rylands and Fletcher, not the tort in Rylands and Fletcher. Third, the fact that the criminal law goes out of its way to punish those who deliberately commit torts in relation to other people, as does tort law itself, where the tort was committed deliberately. Now, I'd counsel against adopting a thicker view of tort law, according to which tort law is identified with pursuing or instantiating or realising a particular goal, because it's too easy to think of examples which run counter to any given thicker view of tort law. For example, Arthur Ripstein presents us with a thicker view of tort law when in his Tort Law in a Liberal State piece he says, "Tort duties protect each person's ability to use his or her means as he or she sees fit, secure from the interference of others. As a result, they don't require anyone to use his or her means in any particular way, best suited to some other person's ability to use his or her means in a preferred way." Okay. Well, Section 3 of Ontario's 1990 Occupiers' Liability Act imposes an affirmative duty on the occupier premises to take reasonable steps to see that a trespass on those premises will be reasonably safe. And even if the trespasser has or is deemed to have taken the risk that he'll be harmed by some dangerous feature, the occupier will still be under a duty to protect him from that dangerous feature if failing to do so would involve a reckless disregard for the trespasser's safety. So what should we say about this duty? If we adopt Ripstein's thicker view of tort law, we might well end up saying that this duty isn't part of tort law at all, because it does the exact opposite of what he says tort duties does. It requires someone to go out to protect somebody's welfare, to protect somebody from suffering harm. But this would be an untenable position. There's absolutely no doubt that the 1990 Occupiers' Liability Act is part of the law of tort. And on my thin theory of what tort law is, there's no problem with that. The 1990 Act confers on people entering an occupier's premises a basic right that the occupier take care to see that they'll be reasonably safe, and specifies what remedies will be available when that right is violated. So, only the thin theory of tort law set out in B and C will do, so far as I can see. So, assuming that B and C are correct, what's the next question we should be looking to answer? I'm convinced that the next question should not be what I call an analytical question. Either the hard law question of what basic rights does tort law give us against other people, or the interpretive question of what ideas or principles best explain why tort law gives us the rights that it does. My primary reason for arguing this is that the law of diminishing marginal returns has begun to apply with quite savage effect to the attempts of tort law revolutionaries to address both the hard law and the interpretive question. For example, take the interpretive question. We now have three main rights-based theories of tort law. The Kantian theory, according to which tort law protects and gives effect to the basic right we have against everyone else that they not violate our independence. Goldberg and Sapersky's theory, according to which tort law gives us rights, but others not act in ways that will leave us with a sense that we've been seriously wronged and desire to seek some redress against the wrongdoer. And my theory, according to which tort law gives us rights against other people that they not act in particular ways if our interests in their not acting in those ways outweigh their interests in being allowed to act in that way, and granting us those rights wouldn't be contrary to public interest. Now, all of these views work to explain the outcomes of a vast majority of tort law cases. Admittedly, each of these views have their comfort and discomfort zones in explaining the law. For example, the fact that in a previous lecture to this group, Arthur Ripstein devoted the entire lecture to explaining one case, Hollywood Silver Fox Farm and Emmett, indicates that that case is in his discomfort zone, as are any cases where defendant's tort liability is dependent on its being shown that the defendant acted with a certain intention or faulty state of mind, as is the case with the economic torts or the tort of misfeasance in public office. On the other hand, I could explain, Goldberg and Sapersky could explain, these sorts of instances of tort liability very easily and quickly. On the other hand, the Kantians have no problem at all with explaining why someone can be held strictly liable in tort for trespassing on someone else's land or converting someone else's property. Even if you weren't at all to blame for what you did, the Kantians would argue that you've still acted wrongfully because you violated someone else's independence in that you've determined for what purposes means that didn't belong to you should be used. Now, people like me and Goldberg and Sapersky have a much tougher time of dealing with those kinds of cases, as my agonized discussion of strict duties in the appendix to the paper accompanying my lecture shows. But the point is that the existence of these comfort and discomfort zones isn't going to make anyone give up thinking that their view best explains what tort law is currently up to. So we have one of those Mexican standoffs that I mentioned at the start of my paper, and no amount of further and better explanations of different people's views of what's going on with tort law at the moment is going to make any difference in resolving the standoff. So what I want to suggest is that we put down the guns and give the analytical questions a rest for a bit. They've been thrashed over so much, there really isn't much further progress to be made or agreement to be won on that front. Where I think we revolutionaries have a much greater chance of really getting somewhere is by addressing the normative question of what basic rights tort law should give us against other people. Now, of course, if we adopt a thicker view of tort law, such as the one advanced by Arthur Ripstein that I was mentioning earlier, then this normative question makes absolutely no sense. On that thicker view of tort law cannot do anything except give us rights that other people not usurp or destroy the means at our disposal. If it does anything else, it stops being tort law. So on this thicker view of tort law, the only possible response tort law can make to my normative question is, in the words of the Sammy Davis Jr. song, "I gotta be me, I gotta be me, what else can I be but what I am?" But my thin view of tort law allows us some space to ask what sort of basic rights tort law should give us against other people. And my paper sets out four possible positions as to what basic rights tort law should give us: G, H, J, and K. My own preferred positions are G and H. I contend in the paper it's not implausible to think that G and H will always arrive at the same conclusions as to what basic rights tort law should give us against other people. If that's right, then G and H can be combined together into a single theory as to how we determine what basic rights we should have against other people. The more determinate H will tell us what those rights should be, and G helps us understand why it's legitimate for the tort law to endow us with those rights, because we would all agree that all of us should have those rights were we attempting to reach the agreement on this issue under fair conditions. But before we can embrace G and H, we have to deal with the very different visions of what rights tort law should give us against other people that are suggested by J and K. Now, both visions are much more restrictive than the visions suggested by G and H. Under K, only rights that preserve people's independence as persons by allowing them a maximal degree of freedom to decide what purposes to pursue with the means at their disposal are acceptable. Rights that undermine that independence by, for example, requiring someone to protect another's welfare are ruled out. For example, suppose some joker pushes you into a lake. Now, that's wrongful under Kant's doctrine of right. Joker is, in this situation, making a decision what direction your body will move in, that's for you to make. But if you're drowning in the lake and some stranger comes along, he won't be doing anything wrong under Kant's doctrine of right if he fails to save you. His refusal to assist you will not interfere in any way with your independence as a person. And the law would be interfering with strangers' independence as a person if it required him to pull you out of the lake. Because by imposing such a duty on a stranger, it would be taking out of his hands the power to decide what to do with his own body. So under K, only independence-protecting rights are acceptable. And this is because we all have a right to independence. But do we? I don't think that this is an idea that we're predisposed to accept. It doesn't form part of our mental furniture. Let me make a couple of points in support of that claim because I think it's really important. First, it's sometimes claimed that the idea that we have right to independence makes sense of our intuitions as to when we're allowed and not allowed to use force against somebody else. So, for example, in an essay called Beyond the Harm Principle, Arthur Ripstein presents a case where he takes a nap in someone's house while they're not there. And Ripstein's doing so has absolutely no effect on the owner of the house. And Ripstein argues that it's only the idea that we have a right to independence that makes sense of why taking a harmless nap in someone else's house can be criminalised. But it's not clear that our intuitions on these matters are shaped by the idea that we have a right to independence. Take the example given by Victor Tadros in his 2011 Oxford Journal of Legal Studies review of Ripstein's Force and Freedom. Suppose that I can save the lives of five people only by nudging you into a lever without your consent. As Tadros observes, most people wouldn't think that doing this is wrong, but it would be if you had a right to independence. Secondly, in 1875, the English courts were confronted with one of the first cases that dealt with the problem of what's called relational economic loss, where you suffer economic loss because someone else's property is damaged. The case was Cattle and Stockton Waterworks. The plaintiff was a guy named Cattle, who was employed to dig a tunnel so as to connect two areas of Knight's land. And the defendants were Waterworks Company. A leak from one of their pipes flooded the area Cattle was working on and made it a lot more expensive for him to complete his work. And he sued the defendant Water Company for compensation, saying, you carelessly failed to keep your pipes in good repair and I suffered loss as a result. Mr. Justice Blackburn turned down Cattle's claim. But look at what he said in turning it down. The question arises, can Cattle sue in his own name for the loss which he has in fact sustained in consequence of the damage which the defendants have done to the property of Knight that has caused him, Cattle, to lose money under his contract? We think he cannot. In the present case, the objection is technical and against the merits, and we should be glad to avoid giving it effect. It may be said that it's just that people like Cattle should have compensation, and that if the law does not give them redress, it is imperfect. Perhaps it may be so. But courts of justice should not allow themselves in the pursuit of perfectly complete remedies for all wrongful acts to transgress the bounds which our law, in a wise consciousness of its limited powers, has imposed on itself of redressing only the proximate and direct consequences of wrongful acts. And 110 years later, in another relational economic loss case, Candlewood Navigation Corp versus Mitsui OSK Lines, otherwise known as the Mineral Transporter, Lord Fraser, giving the judgment of the Privy Council, remarked that the justification for denying a right of action to a person who has suffered economic damage through injury to the property of another is that for reasons of practical policy, it's considered to be inexpedient to admit his claim. Now, of course, the Kantian tort theorists would say all this is nonsense. The law on relational economic loss, as stated in cases like cattle and the mineral transporter, is not imperfect at all and is not based on considerations of practical policy. In a case where I suffer pure economic loss because you've damaged T's property, the reason I can't sue you in tort is that you haven't violated my right to independence by damaging T's property. You've made me worse off, but I can't claim that you've usurped my powers to determine what to do with the means at my disposal or wrongfully destroyed any of the means that were at my disposal. Now, that's absolutely fine. That's absolutely fine. But the point I want to make is that when Kantian tort theorists defend the law in this kind of way, no one I know reacts by slapping their head and saying, "Of course, why didn't I think of that myself?" The reaction is that this explanation is more clever than true. And that's because, fundamentally, the idea that we have a right to independence is pretty alien to us. And so an explanation of the law on economic loss that's couched in terms of our having a right to independence doesn't connect with us in the way that, say, the sort of explanation that Goldberg and Sapersky might offer of such cases does. Now, of course, it could be that each of us does have a right to independence. We're just failing to think straight in failing to acknowledge this. And that's certainly possible. But if we are going to return to the straight path, we will need to be given some sort of argument that will work to persuade us that we're making a mistake by failing to allow some room in our minds for the idea that we have a right to independence. And in the paper, I consider four possible arguments in favour of this idea. The first argument that I consider is that if certain means belong to you, then by definition you must be allowed a maximal degree of freedom to decide how to dispose of those means, otherwise they don't really belong to you. However, this argument rests on an unjustified assertion that being an owner of something implies that you must be allowed as much freedom as possible to decide what to do with the things that you are said to own. I'll still be the owner of Titian's Diana and Actaeon, even if the UK government has forbidden me to sell it abroad. The second argument is that if we impose a duty on stranger, going back to our example, to fish you out of the lake, we'll be treating stranger merely as a means to an end. We'll be violating this moral injunction that we shouldn't treat people merely as a means to an end. Now, as Thomas Scanlon has observed, the injunction that we mustn't treat people merely as means to an end can be taken as an injunction about what attitudes we should have towards other people, or as an injunction about what we are allowed to do to other people. In terms of attitudes, the injunction not to treat others merely as a means to an end requires that we not regard other people as worthless or as equivalent to this watch, which I could just dispose of if I so desire. But if we impose a duty on stranger to pull you out of the lake, I don't think we show that we regard stranger as being worthless or disposable. Now, in terms of what we're allowed to do to other people, the injunction that we shouldn't treat others merely as a means to an end says that we shouldn't coerce or otherwise manipulate people into pursuing ends that they're entitled to decide whether or not they want to pursue them. So we shouldn't trick or force people into doing things where it should be left up to them to decide what they want to do. Now, whether we violate this injunction by imposing a duty on strangers to pull you out of the lake depends on whether he's entitled to decide whether or not saving you from drowning is an end he wants to pursue. But that's precisely what we're trying to establish when we're asking whether he has a right to independence. So whether the injunction not to treat others merely as a means to an end applies in this case depends on whether stranger has a right to independence. So it follows we can't derive a right to independence from the existence of the injunction that we not treat others merely as a means to an end. The third argument is made in the appendix to Ripstein's Force and Freedom. I think the argument basically says, I can't claim to totally understand it, but it basically says, I think, that as rational beings we couldn't agree to live in a society where we enjoyed no independence. Now, I think the problem with this argument is that it treats independence as like being pregnant. You're either fully independent or you're not at all independent. But independence could be a matter of degree. You could enjoy more independence in some aspects of your life and less in others. And it's not clear that we as rational beings could not agree to live in a society where we enjoyed a limited degree of independence. The fourth argument that I consider in favour of the idea that there's a right to independence simply asserts that our independence is so much more important than anything else that the law could never be justified in sacrificing it, even just on occasion, to promote other values. While I say in the paper that I don't think this argument will appeal to any Kantians, one reading of Kant is that for all his talk of forging a pure moral philosophy, completely cleansed of everything that may be only empirical, where the ground of obligation is sought not in the nature of human beings or in the facts about the way the world is, but solely a priori in concepts of pure reason. Despite all that talk, Kant can be read as being someone who in fact attached supreme importance to people's being free. And you can read the groundwork for the Metaphysics of Morals and the Metaphysics of Morals as being written to show how the two great pre-Enlightenment forces that worked to limit people's freedom, law and morality, could be seen as expressions of people's internal and external freedom. So the idea is that Kant in these works is doing a rescue job on law and morality and trying to show people like the authors of French Revolution that actually law and morality are quite consistent with people's autonomy. But if Kant was someone who attached supreme importance to people's being free, he was wrong. Understandably wrong, given the times in which he lived and wrote. I imagine someone who lived under Soviet rule would attach the same supreme importance to people's being free, but still wrong. As what I call the many things matter thesis asserts, while independence does matter, it is valuable, other things matter as well, and the law can rationally choose to trade some of our independence for those other things. In the absence of any other argument justifying K, I think we should reject it. Turning to J, J says that the only basic rights we should be given against other people is that they don't treat us in ways that will make us feel seriously angry towards them. This should also be rejected on the basis that given that many things matter, there's no reason why the rights that tort law gives us against other people should be exclusively devoted to ensuring that our relationships with other people do not deteriorate into being angry and hate-filled. But maybe it's not true that many things matter. The main argument I consider in favour of J is the argument that the amount of love we have for other people is the only thing that matters. And therefore, the only thing that should matter to the law is ensuring that our relationships with other people don't go in the wrong direction, towards hate rather than love. Now, I have a lot of time for the argument that love is the only thing that matters. After all, I don't imagine any but the most self-deluded ever think on their deathbeds, "I wish I'd written more books," or "I can die happy knowing that my enemies have been destroyed and dishonoured." No, ultimately it is by the amount of love you have for other people that you'll measure yourselves. But there's a logical hole in the argument. Don't have a lot of love for him at the moment. But there's a logical hole in the argument that love is the only thing that matters. You can't love someone in abstraction. Loving someone involves wishing good things for that person and sacrificing your own interests for them. So love, paradoxically, cannot exist in a world where only love matters. Other things must matter as well, so that you can wish them for your loved ones and be prepared to give them up yourself so that your loved ones can have them. So the argument that only love matters implodes in a self-contradiction, and the many things matter thesis remains unchallenged by it. So that's the heart of my paper, a rejection of J and K as normative accounts of what rights tort law should give us against other people, which leaves G and H standing, but of course still to be defended and justified. Now it remains to be seen how academics like the Kantian tort theorists and Goldberg and Spursky will react to these arguments. I hope they will come to see that the deep values that underlie their theories of tort law, emphasising the importance of preserving people's independence and the importance of not causing other people to hate us, can be given effect to through a tort law built on G and H. Where I think they go wrong is in attaching overriding importance to these values to the exclusion of everything else. Many things matter and we need to acknowledge that and not ignore it. The remainder of the paper is devoted to two more questions that I think we should be addressing. What remedies should be made available to the victim of a tort when his basic rights have been violated? And how far does tort law fail to live up to the ideals we have for it? But there isn't enough time today for me to go over what I have to say on those questions. Instead, I'd like to finish by sharing with you something that I read recently, a few weeks ago, in a profile of the Nobel Prize winning psychologist Daniel Kahneman, who together with Amos Tversky has helped us to understand just how fallible human beings are in the way they think. And the following passage really resonated with me because, as I make clear at the end of my paper, I really don't think we're going to make any further progress in thinking about tort law by working alone and firing papers at each other. We have to work with each other and in that process work out our differences. Anyway, here's a passage from the December 2011 Vanity Fair profile of Daniel Kahneman by Michael Lewis. Kahneman was working on a paper about human intuition with a fellow scholar named Gary Klein. Klein, as it happened, was the leader of a school of thought that stressed the power of human intuition and disagreed with the work of Kahneman and Tversky. Kahneman said that he did this as often as he could, seek out people who had attacked or criticized him and persuade them to collaborate with him. Most people, after they win the Nobel Prize, just want to go play golf, said Eldar Shafir, professor of psychology and a disciple of Amos Tversky's. Danny's busy trying to disprove his own theories that led to the prize. It's beautiful, really. I think that it is beautiful, and if our work is characterized by the same kind of beauty, then the fifth phase of the revolution in thinking about tort law could be the most exciting yet. Okay, that's it. Okay.
You don't need to be intermediate if you want
questions. No,
I'm
happy.
I want to start, actually.
Go on. Okay.
If I agree with G and H on the sheet, and I go back to your talking about cattle and stock, then I guess my question is, how do those notions of what rights tort law should give us help me answer whether the law should or should not allow for me to recover for contractual, relational, pure economic law?
Well, you look
is
at
that agreement we would make with each other under fair conditions or not?
Yeah, I'm somewhat trapped by the fact that, you know, in order to give people a fair chance to read this, I had to write the paper fairly quickly and so on. G basically is out the window. You know, I'm now sticking with H. So if we just focus on H, on my preferred approach, we simply compare the interests of the people who are involved here, you know, and my interest in not having my work disrupted but as a result of your flooding my works, and your interest in not having to worry about taking endless precautions on checking up beyond your waterworks and so on, you know. But and then we may reach a conclusion there that, well, my interests do in being allowed to do my work and not being disrupted outweigh yours. But then there's another stage. We have to say, well, what are the knock-on effects? What are the side effects of saying that I have a right against you? And what they're doing in Catalan, Stockton and Waterworks and Mineral Transport is they're saying the side effects are horrendous, you know? So
the indeterminate liability.
Yeah. So we should just, for pragmatic policy reasons, refuse to recognize that there's a right here. So I would agree with that. So for me, it's not... This is not obvious that there can't be a duty of care here. It depends on a careful weighing process. Whereas for the Kantians, it's a dead easy case. Dead easy, you know? Don't even have to think about it. Okay.
Professor McBride, let me ask you this. Does tort law have a country, a history, specificity of time and place, or is it just tort law? Is there such thing as Canadian tort law, English tort law, civilian, of course they don't call it tort law daily or whatever. Is this tort law, you speak of tort law as if it's a universal emanation of human community, timeless. Is that, am I mistaken?
I think we have tort law in any community where we have a system of law which imposes duties on particular people, yeah, for the benefit of other particular individuals. Now, it's perfectly possible to think of communities which don't do that, which may have a system of law, but where the interests of particular individuals are regarded as so unimportant or just not even thought about that the only duties you have are duties to work for the benefit of the community or not to do things that are antisocial or harmful to the community. But if you have a country, a legal system, which recognises that I'm important and my importance is such that we are justified imposing duties on you for my benefit, then we have a system of tort law and we grant remedies to you or to me for violation of those duties, then we have a system of tort law. But obviously we have different systems of tort law according to different countries, because different countries will have different views.
Some systems are systemically wrong because they don't conform to a rights-based conception.
I don't want to get into saying, oh well, a country which has no system of tort law is defective or inadequate in some way.
But, or an illiberal system of tort law.
Yeah, but...
they still have tort law.
They have tort law whenever they impose duties on people for the benefit of other particular individuals, and they grant remedies to those individuals when those duties are violated. They have a system of tort law. Some countries may not, so, you know, but I'm not going to say, oh, they should have a system of tort law or whatever. But I'm saying if we in our community are going to have this, then let's start discussing what duties or rights we should have against other people and what remedies we should have for violation of those rights and duties.
Do you teach tort law, English common law of tort? When you teach that subject, do you teach it as the... Do you teach that the principal authorities of tort law are the high English appellate courts, or do you say Immanuel Kant is truly the final authority?
No, as a matter of positive law, it's the decision of the courts and the statutes which tell us what rights we have against each other and so on. But I'm saying that when we're talking about tort law and discussing it and theorising, you know, it would be nice if we got onto this issue of what should be the case rather than endlessly discussing, you know, what is the case or what views or ideas or principles best make sense of what we're up to at the moment. I'd really like us to get onto the normative question, yeah? But when I'm teaching talk, I'm saying this is what the law is, and it's a totally separate question. This is what the law should be.
Do you find yourself then saying frequently that the law is incoherent? It doesn't conform to an appropriate or rationally defensible conception of rights.
Well, I wouldn't say incoherent. I would just say it's undesirable or it's wrong. You know, incoherence is a different thing where you say, well, we've got one area of law which is based on certain values and we've got another which is based on completely different values, and that's a problem. But yeah, you know, so you say this is what the law says, but it's bad. And I try and give some examples at the end of my paper of four areas where I think the area taught law does need looking at and reforming.
What is the idea of tort law as a way of assigning responsibility to people's actions, no matter if they are at fault or not?
I think whenever somebody talks about responsibility, I always tend to think that they're falling back in the 60s and 70s idea of there's a loss here and somebody who should be liable, if anyone, for that loss. And then they say, well, who's responsible for that loss? And so that's the person we will pin the liability on. Whereas for me, those terms are not so important in talking about tort law. And when I'm talking about tort law, it's all about duties, violation of those duties, and remedies. So no necessary connection with ideas of loss, though one of the primary remedies just happens to be you have to repair the consequence of your violation of your right, of the duty that you owed somebody else. So when people like Honoré and so on talk about responsibility for loss and so on, I always think, well, that's a different way of thinking about tort law, and which I don't personally agree with.
Your point, Age talks about setting off costs against benefits. Mm-hmm. Does the theory tell us anything about how you measure the costs and benefits?
Well, that's the huge thing in front of us, you know, which really hasn't been worked on. You know, we need a theory of what really matters, what's important, and so on, and in order to even engage in that balancing sort of process. In the textbook, when I just mentioned this briefly in a footnote, I actually identify H with the natural law position, John Finnis and the natural lawyers, because I think Finnis has gone further than anyone in talking about what is actually good for human beings, what's important, and seeing the law as a whole as attempting to ensure that people get what's good for them and so on. And I think that would be the starting point and so on for that balancing process, you know. But we need theories about what's good, what is important, what matters, and we're not talking about that at all at the moment. I think it's a huge shame because we have a great chance. We have a great chance to do that.
How would you explain then, this might get into your third question, but how would you explain then the purpose of damages? Is it still to bring the victim of a wrong back to where he was before he suffered the wrong, or is it more about compensating him for having a legal right violated?
I'm not averse to what are called the next best theories of damages, compensatory damages, which is the reason why the law is requiring someone to pay compensatory damages. It's the next best way of making someone observe the duty or the rights which they violated by giving money instead of what they should have done in the first place. Where I have a problem is where giving money or putting someone in the position they should have been in had the right not been violated or the duty not been breached involves huge amounts of money. You know, I don't think that can be justified on a next best way. So the example which I've nicked from a London academic, but I think it's a good one, is where you negligently run over Mick Jagger just before he's due to go out on a world tour. And Mick Jagger's looking fairly shabby and so on as he's crossing the road. You have no way of knowing that it's Mick Jagger, you know? You think it's some other 70-year-old and you plough into him and the tour has to be cancelled and he loses millions of pounds, yeah? And those that doesn't actually mean very much to him. You know, it's not very much to him, but it's killing for me, you know, if I have to pay those millions. I don't think you can justify that on a next best idea, but the next best way of observing the right or the duty is to give him millions of pounds. So I think there's scope for thinking about, well, should we moderate awards of tort damages to take account of people's ability to pay and so on, you know? But again, it's something we're not discussing at the moment, but I think we should be. Okay, anything else?
You didn't mention at all economic analysis. Mm-hmm. Is that part of the approach that you're revolting against? Or does it somehow mesh with what you're talking about? Because H reads to me very much like a version of the hand form for negligence.
First of all, economic analysis, so far as it was done in the 70s, was again going back to this idea that tort law is all about redistributing right. losses. So we got a loss, and so we shifted on to somebody else if it would make economic sense to do so, if it would create proper incentives for people to avoid doing harm in future. I'm definitely revolting against that sort of thing. But obviously, when we're weighing things, balancing interests and so on, you know, then you could say, well, that's an economic process and so on, you know. So you could say, well, economics is being reintroduced there through the back door. So we're basically saying, you know, if your interests are really at stake here and I don't have very many interests and I should sacrifice my interests for you, is that an economic idea or moral idea? I'm not sure.
It's like the Miller and Jackson. The neighbours having to sacrifice the peace of mind in the backyard for the community benefits of cricket being played on the village green.
Yeah, except Miller and Jackson is a bit two-faced because they say, well, actually, he shouldn't, you know, have to put up with this, and the cricket ground should stop, but they won't grant the injunction, so it's a very confused
case. Nonetheless, it's a cost-benefit analysis.
So you are kind of doing a cost-benefit analysis, but you could see that as a moral exercise, not just an economic one. You know, economic tends to be a dirty word in my mind. Try and keep away from it. But yeah, you could say it. But it's not done with a view to efficiency. It's not done with a view to the wealth of the community as a whole. You know, it's done for your sake because your interests are important and so on. You know. Okay. Right. Anything else?
If there aren't any further questions, please join me in thanking Nick McBride for his talk.